Adventurous Audio. From idea to ear. When we started Speaking of Suicide podcast, it was aimed specifically at young guys in the Highland community who might struggle with mental health. And we set it up with that aim because there were statistics which demonstrated that suicide rates in the Highlands were typically higher than the Scottish average. Since then, we've evolved because it quickly became evident that while suicide rates are indeed high for young men in the Highlands, suicide and poor mental health isn't confined by geography, gender, or age, nor is it confined by ethnicity. So for this episode of Speaking of Suicide, I'm talking with Trishna Singh, OBE. Trishna is the founder and managing director of Seek San Jog, which she started back in 1989 in Leith in Edinburgh, and it's the only Sikh family support charity in Scotland. Since then, Trishna has become a highly respected representative of the Sikh community in a variety of arenas, not least in discussing mental health, which carries a stigma in all groups, but often comes with additional barriers for minority ethnic groups. In 2024, a Sihat report into the impacts of suicide in the Punjabi community said, "It's not about numbers and statistics, it's about providing the unheard a space to be heard." So with that in mind, I'm here with Trishna to really listen and learn from you, Trishna, about the challenges of suicide and mental health from your perspective and from the perspective of the Sikh and Punjabi community. Trishna, what should I say? Should I say Sikh community, Punjabi community? I'm wanting you to keep me straight all the way through this.
Well, I suppose my... I'm from the Sikh community, but then equally over the years there's been, you learn and you understand about your own community, because I'm first generation born and brought up here in Scotland, and we were mainly, it was all about the Sikh community, and then gradually over the years more people came and people joined the community, and then you begin to realise that actually anybody that was from the Punjab, whether they were Hindu, Muslim or Sikh, they were Punjabis. The religious backgrounds might be different, but the culture and everything is very, very similar. So a lot of the things that I would say apply to the Sikh community would probably apply to the majority of the Punjabi, Hindu or Muslim community.
Do we have any idea of the extent of the problem? How big a problem is mental health within your community? Or is it such a sort of stigma it's difficult to pin down?
Well, I think initially it was such a stigma that you couldn't pin it down. There's been lots of research and projects undertaken and consultations in England, where the community is much, much larger. The whole of the community is the South Asian community. And so there's lots of research that's down there. But it could be applied to Scotland, but it mainly stays down there. And in Scotland, there hasn't been that much research around this, mental health of people from ethnic community. Not to say there's none, but there are some small pieces, but they don't actually touch on the subject. They don't even touch the tip of the iceberg, because, you're into people, the first generation of people that were born here. They've lived their whole life in two cultures, physically and mentally. And then you've got a second and a third generation who, again, they're mental health and the way they live and how they're perceived by both internal community and external community does have an effect on people's mental health. So we don't know what the extent is. And again, there's lots of small projects and consultations and reports that have come out. And just to give you an example, like post-COVID, there was a huge big the inquiry about the impact of COVID on all different communities. But there was absolutely nothing in Scotland about the impact of COVID on the Sikh community. So we managed to get some funding and do a small report on the impact of COVID on the Sikh community in Scotland. And actually the findings were very stark. And there were, recommendations, but what we found the most thing was the effect on people's mental health. And As an organisation, primarily we work with women and their families, which has included men over the years. But that piece of research made us actually look at the fact that we needed a separate service for men. And so we did a pilot, and it's growing, it's running, but there's the state of mental health for men. There is nothing for men ethnic communities for their mental health. There is nowhere that they can go and speak. And this is coming from people. Just to give you an example, yesterday I was at a funeral and I bumped into somebody, a male cousin, hadn't seen him for a long time. And I was surprised that he actually said that I've heard that you have started a men's support group, health group. And he said it's so much needed. People don't realise how isolated men are from the Sikh community. He says we're all older and there's nothing for us.
Until you know sort of the statistics or know what you're dealing with, how do you know there's a problem?
Exactly.
So how do you know there's something that needs supporting?
It was that very small piece of research, the impact of COVID on the Sikh community. It was a rounded thing, but what came out of it was how much it affected men, the mental health. So it was coming from them themselves, the small number that we interviewed, but it was quite an eye-opener in the sense that they were actually saying that we feel that we need some help with our mental health.
And that was unusual in and of itself, was it?
Yes, it was unusual. And again, all of this is anecdotal that people would say, because it's conversations that I've had with individuals or with people that, you know, have come to Sikh Sindhog. And but then we're a small organisation. We don't have that kind of finances and resources to actually do a massive big 3-year consultation, but that's what it needs, to look at the statistics. And again, if we go on to the subject of suicides, that is high. But we only know it's high, again, anecdotally, because we know of people who have lost family members, and it's just been all of a sudden this person is kind of like they passed away. But nobody mentions the word suicide.
So it's terribly difficult to know how high,
yeah,
and what high looks like, mm-hmm, when, by the sounds of it, people aren't necessarily talking about it.
No.
What are the barriers to talking about it within the community? Why isn't it a subject that people feel that they can talk about?
There's the stigma, there's the shame, the dishonour to the family name, and a whole range of things like that, and sort of bringing shame to the families, like this family couldn't cope or they couldn't look after that family member, and so they've taken their own lives. And again, this is my observation over the years of observing when these things have happened, and, you know, like not fully understanding at that point, but afterwards. And it's kind of, again, anecdotal, but then you hear things and people say, actually, this is what happened. Now, I can remember, I was born and brought up in Glasgow, way back in the 70s, we knew there was a female member of our community who took her own life, but nobody ever spoke about it. Nobody mentioned it, but she did take her own life. We know she did. And I can remember that, like, that was in the 70s. It was the mid-70s. And she was someone who'd been through a lot in a, you know, very short age. And then all of a sudden, whatever it was that tipped her over the edge, she took her own life. And nobody even, I don't even know if it was recorded as that or how, you know, how it was taken up by the authorities or anything. So if I can remember back to the 70s of something like that happening, we don't know how many other people there are from, and it's a big community, it's a growing community. Okay, if you weigh up against the mainstream white Scottish community, yeah, it's a minority within a minority. But that doesn't mean to say these things don't happen. I mean, it's the same, I suppose, the stigma within the white Scottish community. I mean, you were talking about the Highlands and places like that. Probably 30, 40 years ago, where they were with that kind of situation.
What really struck me about what you said was that the business of it feeling like it brings shame on the family, because yeah, the family think it looks like they couldn't look after someone.
Yeah.
And that's not an angle I've heard before in these conversations we've had about suicide and mental health. And so I think it's particularly interesting that the idea that it connects to a lot of people I talk to about this obviously always feel that there must have been something they could have done, that they should have done, that they should have said. That why is always, I think, hanging over there. But it does make me wonder if there's a stigma and if these conversations are pushed away because of those kind of concerns, to what extent does that make it much more difficult to deal with the grief? Suicide is an incredibly difficult loss in anyone's book, but if you've pushed that down and not been able to talk about it, I wonder if that makes it even harder.
It's horrendous. So it's kind of like when you know what's happened in a family and then people are just talking about it as a death. Do you know what has happened? The person, just people will say they were ill or whatever. And yet you know that actually this person died from suicide. It was a suicide, it wasn't just an illness. And then you think about the effect that has on the whole family of one that actually continuing to have to hide something and, like you say, you know, process all of that grief of the loss. So sometimes it even makes my mind boggle to think, how do people cope with that? And there are some situations where people have been able, and I think they're very brave, to actually say, well, actually, it was suicide. And I think in some ways I've observed that, and recently when some families have thought, no, there's nothing that we can do to cover this up because it happened in such a way that there was nothing to say that, oh, this person was ill or that happened or that happened. That's what happened. And so they've had to deal with it. But I think I can see that the way they are dealing with it is actually, it doesn't make anything easier at all. And the grief is just unmentionable, like what people go through. But there is a certain peace, do you know what I mean? Like that, just because there's that acknowledgement and they don't have to hide what happened to that person and their family. By not hiding it and not having to cover it up, it has made it easier to talk about it, even if it's amongst themselves. But it's still easier than rather than having that burden also on them. Don't say, and families are big, do you know, like the extended families. So then how many people are you able to kind of control in that way by saying, we don't want anybody to know that's what happened?
If you can't talk about it or don't talk about it, that can make you more vulnerable because there's so much pressure that comes with a loss to suicide that by having no outlets, that would add to that burden. I mean, we already know that by losing someone to suicide, you become more vulnerable to suicide yourself. And it sounds like that would be potentially even more so in a community that feels unable to talk about that. But again, I presume there aren't going to be statistics that relate to that because it's this hidden problem, which is a great worry.
Yeah, and it's a great worry. And then equally, if you kind of go by what's written and from the religious aspect of it, suicide is considered a sin against life because it's not your life to take. And in the Sikh scriptures, it's like atmahatya means suicide. So for someone to take their own life is considered, you know, against the will of God because you're born and you're born by the will of God and you die by the will of God. Your time is mapped out. So sometimes people will kind of look at it from that aspect. But whatever it is that makes people go to that edge and go and go into that space in their head to be able to do that, it is all about mental health. And so from the very outset, if we're not looking after people's mental health, nobody knows where to go, nobody knows who to speak to.
I want us to come on and talk more about some of the answers to some of this. But for the moment, let's return to the issue of mental health itself and to some extent the kind of causes of it. I mean, if you're in a community where you know people do struggle with mental health but are not able to talk about it, doesn't that then become even more pressure for someone who is struggling. Doesn't that exacerbate the problem?
It does, but the thing is, like I said, as a small organisation, there's only so much that we can do. And we have, over the years, offered counselling support. And we have went through the regular routes of counselling. And for some people from the South Asian community, that works. For the vast majority of them, it doesn't work, because it's a different... Even although they've been born and brought up here and everything, there is something inherent that kind of, like, some people will be fine talking to anybody, any counsellor, white, black, green, blue, Scottish, Asian, whatever. But there are some people that don't get that concept. It's like, I'm just going to be talking and I don't want to relive it.
Do you think there are particular things that relate culturally to the Sikh community which cause poor mental health that need to be recognised? Are there specific things to do with gender, to do with how the culture is set up, or and some of the beliefs that underpins it, which makes for mental health challenges?
I'm not a psychotherapist or anything like that, right? And I'm not a psychologist. But over my years of observing, right, it is that having to live your life in two cultures, mentally and physically, is a huge burden to carry all your life. You've got one foot in either camp. You have a first generation that was born and brought up here that are now in their 70s. And some of them are going into their 80s, but they were born in Scotland, okay? But that their home life was exactly as though it was planted from the villages of India, because when those people's parents came over here, they came over from traumatic experiences. They lost everything. Their home, they became homeless, landless, and it was because of the partition of India and Pakistan. So those people that came directly over here, at the request or invitation of the British government at that time, these people came and settled here. But what they settled here with was the mindset of their lifestyles at home and the culture and the fact that they were here. They didn't want to lose any of that. So at home, everything was completely, you know, the way it would be in India. And then you stepped out and then you had to become part of the mainstream society. So there was all of those things going on all the time, and they still are, even to this day, even though people think we've evolved, we're in a third, fourth, fifth generation of being born and brought up here. But mentally, there's still that two-culture thing going on. People perceive assimilation in many different ways. But I can't paint myself white, because is that what people think is assimilation? Because our lifestyles, like I said, are two lifestyles. And we can easily fall into each one. But then that can cause, for some people, where families are much more kind of still very steeped in the cultural things, not the religious, it's the cultural things of different ways of doing things and how a family perceives, just for example, even like arranged marriages or, you know, relationships and things like that. That causes huge turmoil in families. And although we have progressed as a whole community, but there is still that underlying thing that's there that bubbles away under the surface. And people will, on the surface, will now say, we accept, it doesn't matter, you know, what the background is, as long as our child is happy, that's fine. And for a lot of people, that's changing within families. But a lot of families don't see it like that. So all of these things affect your mental health. You can't pinpoint it, and you cannot say, that's just the cause of it, or that's just the cause of it. But for some people, it can become, you know, like they can be here. Like, we've got people that are third generation here who think they're assimilated. And then they'll go into step into a career where it's kind of like, blimey, I don't know. I've never heard of discrimination. I've lived my whole life here. But now I know what discrimination feels like, because I've stepped into an area where it's still very, very white dominated. And although people are open and welcoming and everything like that, there is that element there. And then when people, younger people now, who are stepping out into all the different areas of work and professional backgrounds and everything, and there are some places where it's very stark for them. And so when you hear them speaking, and I think, you know, like, we were kind of cosseted from that, because growing up as girls, we were allowed so much freedom. So we never actually experienced that being in a workplace where it was dominated by white, and you were the only brown person there, we didn't really experience that as a first generation of women being born and brought up here, but the men did. And now we've got whole generations of males and females experiencing that kind of, getting that feeling of being the token brown, and yet they feel that they're not.
And even so, when you're coming across all these points of that can create mental friction or whatever you want to describe it as, if you're coming from a culture that traditionally doesn't express these problems, doesn't talk about these problems, doesn't matter whether you've gone and suddenly, you know, assimilated into a culture, yeah. If your background says we don't talk about mm-hmm. these things, we don't talk about how challenging we're finding this, you've still got this inability potentially to be able to express it and talk about it and communicate about it and describe if you're having mental health problems. Yeah. If there aren't pathways to be expressing mental distress, mental problems, does it come out in other ways? Do you see, because these things don't go away.
No.
Obviously, sadly, suicide is a route that I know that you've witnessed in people close to you and part of the community. But are there other ways? Is it, you know, how else do people cope?
The thing is, a lot of people become addicted to medication. So if you went to see your doctor and you're coming, you know, like presenting as feeling depressed or your mental health is not great, the first thing that you get is medication. And over the years, again, we've observed lots of people who we know have been through a very traumatic experience and they're not coping and they go to the doctors. And these people have become addicted to things like diazepam and whatever it is that's out there now, and they feel that they can't come off them, because obviously if they're starting to come off them, the withdrawal symptoms can be really horrendous. And so there's that fear that if I stop taking this, I'm going to become really ill. So there's a lot of that goes on, and there's lots of people that probably self-medicate. We don't know.
It was interesting, Trishna. I was looking around doing a bit of research into this, and I was looking on it was a Facebook support group, I think, based in Solihull. And there was a couple of comments there, again, anecdotal evidence, but I was struck by them and I thought I'd read them to you just to see whether it chimed with what you understood from your community. And one comment said, it's due to the fact that we've never had the luxury of depression or mental health due to work and family responsibilities. However, as we've gone up the prosperity ladder, we've had more time to deal with the topic of mental health, but no tools to deal with it. Only substance abuse, which we seem to use as a coping method.
Yeah, that's because the substance misuse is mainly alcohol. So alcohol is the biggest substitute that people turn to.
I thought it was so interesting to say we've never had the luxury
yes.
of depression or mental health due to work and family responsibilities.
Yes. And that in itself is a cycle, because at first it was like you have to make sure that everybody's got everything that they need, and then it's like planning the marriages, and then it's getting on to people's, people passing away in the family and all the family responsibilities that go with any family. But in South Asian families, it's more so because of the extended families. And it's not that the extended families are the same as they used to be. Things have evolved and changed, but there is still that connection is still there.
Just to quote to you one more piece from the Facebook site I was looking at, another one that struck me. Someone said, there is a strong emphasis on maintaining family honour, so it can be difficult to discuss issues with family or friends. Mental health is often misunderstood, and conditions like depression or anxiety may be dismissed as temporary sadness rather than a medical condition requiring treatment. What interests me is, in all the stories or comments that people were writing, family is clearly absolutely fundamental to your community. It's really important in terms of the culture, but it's often the family that we look to for support when we're struggling.
Yeah.
And there's that friction between you want to look to the family, I would imagine, for support, and yet seemingly admitting that you're having mental health problems cuts against family
honour
in some way. And
yeah.
I,
And it's kind of like, I suppose, when it cuts across, when you say about the honour, I think it's more about the stigma that people will feel that I'm not good enough or I've failed for myself.
And of course, we all feel that, actually. Yeah. And I think in any society you might feel that, but maybe within...
It's amplified because you're still, again, there's all of that othering that goes on, like that other community. And like I said, we know that there's, again, from internal evidence, observation of all these projects and things that we've been involved in, there are, you know, groups of people that we know that would be quite happy and get a lot out of actually having the support of a mainstream white councillor who's listening to them, but now gradually you're beginning to see a shift in thinking. Some people will say, actually, if it was an Asian councillor, she or he would understand the intricacies and the kind of things that I'm talking about, the nuances about talking about extended family members. A Scottish councillor might think, well, what's your uncle's cousin's wife got to do with you? Whereas somebody from a South Asian background would understand completely because they would know that actually that's what extended families are. They might not be living with you. You don't have to be living with them, but there are things that will happen that can affect you. And in Scotland now, it's been running for a wee while. It's called the South Asian Council and Association. They're based in Glasgow. I think it's Glasgow or Bathgate. So they might have, you know, some more, and I've just come across them recently. But, you know, obviously they've done research or looked at, you know, that, and that's why they've been able to set this up.
Because, by the sounds of things, you need to understand the cultural nuances and subtleties, and that doesn't just come overnight. No. That needs to come from someone who understands the community.
Yeah. So again, it's not about wanting to create a new, whole new mental health service. It's about actually being inclusive and acknowledging that in mainstream, whether it's the NHS, through the NHS, the support that you'll get, that needs to acknowledge the fact that we have people, we have citizens of Scotland who contribute to the economy who will need this service. And it's the othering that needs to stop now.
So there's different things, by the sound of it, that needs to shift. There needs to be a shift in terms of recognising a much more targeted, culturally specific service and support kind of service. But what needs to change from within the community to allow people to be able to talk about suicide? Suicide is difficult to talk about whichever community you're in. Yeah. But what needs to be released in order for people to be able to say, this has happened? Because until, by the sounds of what you're saying, until they do, it's going to be really difficult to get a good support services.
Yeah, it's a kind of like a drip thing. So, for example, through our organisation, we will discuss these kind of topics that are difficult for people to help them. It might not affect them directly, but they might be able to pass it on to somebody else.
I know that you've experienced grief from suicide close to you, and we won't go into the specifics of that, but I wonder the extent to which you felt, because of that, you know, very aware of the lack of support or the pockets of what was missing for you and people close to you who were experiencing grief from suicide.
Yeah, it was having had that experience and thinking we'd heard, like I said, I mean, I went back to the 1970s when we know that this woman took her own life. Everybody was talking about it, but that was it.
Everybody was talking about it, but not talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Yes. And so, but then after all those years, I mean, like 50 years later, you're experiencing it and you're thinking, what's changed? Is there anybody that really understands? And why do we not talk about it? You know, so I think that's what made me think that it's such a traumatic thing. And for people not to have the right support or not know what to do or where to go. And somebody needs to start the conversation.
We're a multicultural society, and we need a multicultural approach to mental health and suicide and conversations around it.
Yes, yes. And the thing is, people think saying multicultural is an outdated thing, but then what else are you supposed to use? It is multicultural.
And what would encourage, do you think, people from the Sikh community, Punjabi community, to come forward and start speaking? Because until we truly know the size of the problem and the proper nature of the problem and the detail and nuances of the problem, it sounds like it's going to be very difficult to fit in that support, that culturally specific support. Yeah.
But then the thing is, like, there's many different ways of getting to that point. But the first thing that we need actually is a real focused attempt on getting together to collate the figures that's what's happening in Scotland. So when they have the breakdown of male suicides, within that breakdown, how many are they from the South Asian communities? We don't know. And the families who are suffering from it, again, they might not be suffering in isolation. They might be getting support from somewhere. But if they're not sharing that with anybody else, then there could be other people in the same boat, but they don't know. So there's something around that kind of, and like I said, it's like drip feeding. It's like the places of worship, that's where the communities gather. So it's these kind of places where you need to be having a proper presence, but not a one-off, like go in and pick a banner up and disappear. It's about actually having a presence there, or having banners or posters there that people can see and pick up leaflets. And maybe somebody being there for them to see, actually, this person. People, because we know from our experience, as a family support organisation, we've been around for this 37 years. It's like drip feeding. And the things that we've been able to touch on and offer support to the women and the community has been in that way. It's building up that trust. And people not just coming up to us and saying, oh, I need help with this. No, it's like under a smokescreen or umbrella of, you know, having a drop-in session or having a trip or something, but it's been the drip feeding of being somewhere and letting people know that we're around. And it's like, you know, there'd be cards that they put up in the toilets and things like that. It's people knowing that there is somewhere that we can go who will be able to understand us from our cultural aspect.
So a lot of change needs to come.
There is. It's a huge area. It's very hidden still in Scotland.
What support, if any, is there currently? If someone's listening to this and thinking, I'm struggling, I do want to be able to talk, but I do want to be able to talk to someone within my community, where would you say they should go, Trishna?
Well, I mean, there's lots of helplines and things out there now, and there's the Sikh helpline, but then there's also Sikh Sandog is based in Edinburgh. We might not be the experts on anything, but we do have links with other organisations, and it's a safe space for you to come and maybe even just talk about it and not want any help, but just to be able to get it out of your system and know that I've spoken to somebody. And so we are here, we are based in Edinburgh. We would do our best to help connect people with the, even if it's a mainstream organisation that's had some cultural awareness from either ourselves or from other South Asian community, which they are, lots of people are doing. And then, so we might be able to put you in touch with a place that already has somebody, but we don't know until something happens or somebody comes to us.
And we will put all the contact details for Sikh Sandog in the show notes, of course. Trishna, it has been lovely seeing you. Great talking to you. And thank you. Thank you for putting your head above the parapet and for talking about this. I know, as I said, it was a thought for you to do it, but you felt really strongly about doing it, and I really appreciate you talking to us for Speaking of Suicide.
Yeah, and I just hope that people, anybody that's listening to it, knows that it's coming from a place of love for the community and for the knowledge of knowing that there are people suffering out there and that they shouldn't be suffering alone.
I was talking to Trishna Singh, OBE of Sikh Sandog. I've done a bit of a hunt and I've put links to a range of Asian specific and BAME support services in the show notes, where I've also put a link to Seek Sanjog if you want to find out more about Trishna and her work. Don't forget, if you need someone to talk to or some help, then you can, of course, text Mikey's line on 07786 20 77 55, or you can contact them via Messenger, web chat, and WhatsApp. The number for WhatsApp is 01463 729 000. Again, all those details and links are in the show notes. Speaking of Suicide is funded by Mikey's Line, and the platform is sponsored by Highland-based family firm D&D Paving Limited. If you'd like to sponsor an episode or a series, do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. You can email bethechange@mikeysline.co.uk. That's bethechange@mikeysline.co.uk. Speaking of Suicide is produced by Adventurous Audio Limited.